Chapter 14 Electric People. I have known many distinguished scientists over several decades and had opportunities to sit around discussing these issues with many of them, often for hours and sometimes for days. The first scientific Nobel laureate I met when I was 18 was Paul Dirac, 1902 to 1984. Who won the Nobel Prize for Physics as long ago as 1933. I went to tea with him in his rooms at Cambridge and spent 4 hours with him. He was a great admirer of tea time and made quite a fuss of it, pouring tea and serving dainty little sandwiches, small tarts and cakes. Dirac was a very solitary and silent person, and he rarely talked to people. I seem always to have had a way of getting such people to chat. In Dirac's case, I instinctively knew that I must sit in my chair at a 60-degree angle from him so that he could talk without being observed, as it were. He had, in fact, put the chair there himself, and I knew that its angle was the key to having a conversation with him, as he could not talk to people comfortably if they were looking directly at him face on. Dirac shyly confessed to me that he was far more interested in biology than he was in physics, but he said he did not dare to tell that to anybody in Cambridge. Dirac did not accept physics as it was at that time. He complained that no one would listen to him about quaternions. They are a number system that he believed essential for understanding quantum mechanics, but which his contemporaries insisted had no practical applications. And he thought physics was in many ways on the wrong track. This had a big impact on me, for there I was in conversation with a living legend of science, and he criticized the very foundations of the science of his time, and even preferred a different scientific discipline from his own because it was more lively. That was an early encouragement to my own skepticism about anything and everything that, quote, everybody believes, unquote. I have an inclination to think that everybody, in quotes, is always wrong. We discovered that we had both entered university at the age of 16, and we talked about that and how it teaches one to be a bit isolated from one's contemporaries, because they are not really contemporaries chronologically at all, but already well on the way towards becoming ossified and rigid. I have written a long account of that interesting meeting, which perhaps I shall publish one day. Dirac was one of the few scientists who have had the courage to speak of these uncertainties openly, like my hero Percy Bridgman did in his books. Bridgman had won his Nobel Prize in 1946. He had been a famous Harvard professor for decades, and he did not give a damn if querulous and timid colleagues decided to turn on him, savage him, and call him crazy, because he was pointing out that not only one emperor, but many wore no clothes. Bridgman was that most honest of persons, someone who is not afraid to admit that he does not know things. He admitted that he did not know what a field actually was. But he went further and said that no one did. My old friend David Bohm is well known for formulating his alternative interpretation of quantum mechanics, which involves something that he called the quantum potential. When I asked him what the quantum potential actually was, he said he did not know, and that no one really knew what any of the potentials in science were. He had come up with the idea mathematically, and hoped one day to find out what it was, but meanwhile it was just there in the equations, and he could describe what it did, but not explain what it was. It is heartening to know that there are some famous physicists who have courage. But if you have courage in life, you will suffer, because the herd will attack you. Most of my scientist friends, or good acquaintances, many of them very famous indeed, have been at heart renegades. What does it mean to be a renegade? It means that you use your own brain rather than the herd's brain. I befriended David Bohm in 1982, when he was professor of theoretical physics at Birkbeck College, London. The reason I mention David at this point is because I want to quote from my own article, These are the words of his that come from the voluminous sound tapes which I made with him over the course of many meetings. And this article is something I wrote for The New Scientist. What is an electric field? We don't know. If we knew, we would know why field and charge are connected in a particular way in which they are. When I was a child, people would say, electricity is very mysterious. Now we say it's not so mysterious, but still nobody knows what electric force really is. We're used to it, that's all, by giving it a name and getting used to handling it. What is a gravitational potential? What is an electrical potential? What is a quantum potential? You see, you would have to explain all the forces and explain why they act on particles. Now, nobody has done that. That's the end of the quote. The non-scientist may be astounded to hear this confession from one of the most famous physicists of the 20th century. But many of the most brilliant scientists have expressed these and similar sentiments not only in private, but in many articles and books. One example was my close friend Peter Mitchell of Proticity and the Protic Motor, which I discussed near the beginning of this book, who insisted to me many times that nobody knows what energy really is. And the famous physicist Richard Feynman was honest about our ignorance. He bluntly said, "I think I can safely say that nobody understands quantum mechanics." And elsewhere he made statements such as these, quote, "Whether the proton decays or not is not known. To prove that it does not decay is very difficult. There are quantum theories of gravity, but there is no way to test them. The best of these theories is not able to include the particles that we do find, and invents lots of particles that we don't find. There remains one especially unsatisfactory feature, the observed masses of the particles. There is no theory that adequately explains these numbers. We use the numbers in all our theories, but we don't understand them, what they are, or where they come from." Nobel laureate Ilya Prigozhin, whose work was discussed in Chapter 3, said, quote, "I think we are only at the beginning of science. We are at the beginning of studying the complexity of nature. The classical universe was a simple, quiet universe. And now we see, we only conceive the extraordinary complexity of nature, like, for example, the complexity of the gene expression. We still don't understand completely the structure of the gene. Yet I don't think that once we understand the structure of the gene, we shall see the meaning of man, because the genetic content of a mouse and a man are very similar. Therefore, the non-genetic part of biology is very important. We know little about it. In addition, I would say there is no fundamental science. Why do we have so many elementary particles? Nobody knows. We still don't know the origin of the universe. The theory of the Big Bang is the most widely accepted theory, but what is the Big Bang? We are at the beginning. I always say that we are at the beginning of a new science, not at the end of science." Unquote. So now we come to another remarkable man and great scientist, Albert St. Georgi, 1893-1986. Who became a great influence on many pioneers in this field, and with his contemporaries Alfven, Bostick, Kapitza, and Cope, one of the great heroes of the history of plasma. He was a Hungarian whose surname means St. George and is pronounced just like St. Georgi, even though the Hungarian spelling looks different. He was the second scientific Nobel laureate whom I met when I was 21. He won the Nobel Prize for Physiology and Medicine in 1937, when he was still professor of medical and organic chemistry at the University of Szeged in Hungary. By the time I met him, he was an exile living in America, whither he had fled in 1947 from the communist regime of his native country, and he was working at the marine biology lab of the Woods Hole Institute on the coast of Massachusetts, where I visited him for an afternoon. Things had not gone happily for him in Hungary during the Second World War because of the Nazis. He had led a resistance movement against them and saved many Jews from being killed, and was lucky not to have been captured, tortured, and killed by the Gestapo himself. The Hungarian Prime Minister sent him to Cairo to negotiate secretly with the Allies, and Hitler personally issued a warrant for his arrest. St. Georgi was a larger-than-life extrovert character, with a ravaged face, a good sense of both humor and sarcasm, and someone who was not shy when it came to letting his genius glitter in conversation. What is important for our story is that it was St. Georgi who laid the true scientific foundations for the electric view of humans, and of all plants and animals also, for that matter. It is not for nothing that his most famous and provocative books are Bioenergetics, 1957, and Bioelectronics, 1968. I met with him in the summer of 1966, before the latter book was published. In 1976, he carried his views further and published Electronic Biology and Cancer. He believed that cancer was a condition associated with electrical and electronic malfunctions within the body. St. Georgi's Bioenergetics is such an amazingly provocative, challenging, and brilliant book that its full effect has not been felt even today, for it contains insights that have yet to be pursued. It is a bombshell still going off, even though it appeared 75 years ago. I don't imagine any physicist read it at the time, because it is so heavily technical about biochemistry that few, if any, physicists could have understood most of it. It was published before the discipline now called biophysics came into being. In fact, it was St. Georgi who helped to provide the impetus for the founding of the science of biophysics, by injecting discussions of physics into biochemistry to such an extent that biochemists were forced to learn some physics in order to comprehend what he was telling them. Indeed, St. Georgi, in his 1976 book, Electronic Biology and Cancer, based a portion of his arguments upon the work done by the famous French physicist Léon Brillouin, who died in 1969, thereby forcing any of his colleagues who wished to understand him to study Brillouin's unique discoveries about electrons and the energy levels named Brillouin zones after him. Brillouin had been insisting that semiconductors existed inside the body. Also, St. Georgi had referred to Percy Bridgman's seminal book, The Physics of High Pressure, 1949, forcing his colleagues to read Bridgman in order to understand one of St. Georgi's most important ideas. For more than 20 years, St. Georgi had been relentlessly pushing physics into biology, and it was becoming impossible to ignore this, so that the discipline of biophysics had to be born to cope with it. He remarked in his 1957 book Bioenergetics, quote, "Experimental evidence for the existence of a semiconductor nature of biological material is not missing, bearing in mind that semiconductors are necessary for the ordered flow of electricity. Chloroplasts, the tiny organelles inside plants that carry out the process of photosynthesis, can store light, that is, conserve the energy of absorbed photons, which energy they could again shoot out later in the form of light, if heated. That energy can move through protein molecules is an experimental fact. I have no doubts that the coming century will witness a profound revolution, extension of biology, the establishment of a quantum mechanical biochemistry. This book may be but one of the early swallows of this spring." Unquote. We will see later that the quantum mechanical qualities of plasma, some of which we have already touched on, are crucial for understanding its role in the evolution of high levels of intelligence. Bioenergetics was indeed an early swallow, and an influential one. It may have gone unread by many people, but they knew it was there, lurking. It is immediately obvious, if one thinks about it, that Albert St. Georgi was an outstanding genius who was denied proper recognition in the United States. He discovered vitamin C and won the Nobel Prize, But was he ever offered a professorship in America? No. Was he ever headhunted by one of the Ivy League universities? No. Did the Institute of Advanced Studies at Princeton ever try to recruit him? No. Was he ever awarded any of the usual distinctions? No. Instead, he took refuge in an oceanographic institute, which is what Woods Hole is, and he was given a job in a marine biological laboratory. What on earth did St. Georgie have to do with fish? Pretty much nothing. In fact, he was relegated eventually to something called the Institute for Mussel Research. It is true that he had done a lot of research on mussel and was one of the world's experts on the subject, but for him that was a sideline. What was really going on was that the American scientific establishment was clearly afraid of St. Georgie, wishing to exclude him from the mainstream, and tried to prevent him upsetting all of their empty apple carts. The appearance of bioenergetics, throwing a bomb into the middle of all conventional biological thinking, did nothing to render him less dangerous to the mediocre minds of the establishment figures. With his book Bioelectronics, 1968, St. Georgie became even more of a threat to standard thinking. His first two sentences in his book are, quote, "The greatest stride in biology in our century was its shift to the molecular dimension. The next will be its shift towards the submolecular electronic dimension." Unquote. He went on to speak of plasma existing in every molecule in the body, saying each molecule contains something that can be looked upon as an electron gas pervading the whole molecule. Publishing something like this, insisting that there was a branch of biology that was electronic, that every cell in the body was electronic, and that every molecule contained plasma, was too much for the scientific establishment. Most biologists did not have the faintest idea how electronics worked even in a radio, much less in a molecule. The more St. Georgie published things that required people to stretch their minds, asking biologists to learn a little bit about physics and a little bit about electronics, the more certain it became that he would never be accepted or recognized in America. He could not go back to Hungary because he would probably have been arrested, tortured, and shot. He was also not in favor with the American security establishment because he had led an anti-Nazi movement, whereas America in the 1950s and 1960s was being flooded with ex-Nazi scientists being brought over by Alan Dulles of the CIA as part of Operation Paperclip and other such projects. But worst of all for St. Georgie was the fact that Hitler's personal hypnotist, Ferenc Vogelsang, who had carried out hypnotic experiments on more than 60,000 Jews and gypsies in the death camps, had become Alan Dulles' little darling, given a new identity as Frank, treated as an American, and put in charge of all the American security establishment's mind control operations. And he was Hungarian. Vogelsang, which is V-O with an umlaut, L-G-Y-E-S-I, Vogelsang, was clearly going to use his influence with Dulles to prevent a distinguished anti-Nazi Hungarian from gaining any recognition at all in America, lest St. Georgie might spill the beans on Vogelsang being a war criminal and a fanatical Nazi responsible for the abuse, torture, and deaths of thousands of Jews. The CIA must have gone into full gear to keep St. Georgie as obscure as possible, hidden away in his little port on the Massachusetts coast, and buried in harmless mussel research, given no attention and having no opportunity to acquire an audience who might ever listen to him. St. Georgie was in any case handicapped by terrible personal grief, because both his wife and his daughter had died of cancer by 1972. When he dedicated his book, The Living State, with observations on cancer, to their memory, saying in his introduction that cancer took away most of what was dear to me, and in his preface, he thanked those few people who had helped to keep me above water. A brief but fascinating account of a conversation with St. Georgi has been published in Andrew Marino's autobiography. They met in San Francisco in June of 1980. St. Georgi died in 1986. St. Georgi complained bitterly to Marino that he had never been able to get any federal grants for his research during his years in America, confirming my suspicion that he was blacklisted by the security agencies to make sure he never received any support for anything at all. Despite all this, Albert St. Georgi laid the groundwork for crucial discoveries and developments in science by helping to create the discipline of biophysics and introducing so many new and exciting notions that are still being explored today. For instance, he is looked upon as the grandfather of biophoton research, a subject I will be discussing in Chapter 15. He describes how ultra-weak photons are emitted by the body, which, when their emission is correctly detected, has enormous implications for the early detection of diseases, especially cancer. He also laid the groundwork for much of Peter Mitchell's work, turning upside down the discipline of bioenergetics and the explanation of how energy is used within the human body, and explaining how energy is transported across membranes and used in cells. But the main point of all this for us here is that the details of what St. Georgi says in his books relate directly to the nature, structure, and workings of intelligent plasma entities. In bioenergetics, St. Georgi refers to the fact there are several different kinds of ice. This may surprise many people. Surely ice is ice, isn't it? Well, no, not really. St. Georgi found this information briefly referred to in Percy Bridgman's The Physics of High Pressure. Bridgman was possibly the world's leading investigator of high pressure phenomena, and he refers to the high pressure modification of ice. With the correct pressure techniques, one could change one form of ice into another. He could change ice 1 into ice 3, ice 5, and ice 6, for instance. All these are ices made of pure water, but they are different water ices. Research into different ices continues today. In 1998, the number of different kinds of ices increased to 12, as Lobben, Finney, and Coos published in Nature an account of their discovery of ice 12. But by 2016, the number of ices had grown to 18. Although these different ices are described as crystalline phases of ice, they vary a great deal. Their oxygen atoms tend to remain in fixed positions relative to each other, but their hydrogen atoms do not. In addition to the 18 crystalline ices, there are 3 non-crystalline ices known as amorphous ices. So that makes 21 kinds of ice so far, all of them made solely from water. There is also hair ice, which exists as thin threads spreading between trees, and ice flowers, which are produced by some plants but not others. No one knows why. Does this mean there are 23 kinds of ice? Are there more? What does it mean to have 21 kinds of ice, or 23, or fewer, or frankly even only 2? Are the different ices also different kinds of matter, or is ice just ice, regardless of which of the 18 or 21 or 23 kinds it is? Crucially, it is not only ice that behaves in various strange ways. In bioenergetics, St. Georgi may have caused the greatest upset of all to his colleagues by discussing the weird nature of water. These days, there are many books, many of them New Age titles, discussing different kinds of water at great length. They concern such ideas as water having memory, to explain how homeopathy is possible, where the dilution of a drug in water is so extreme that not one molecule remains, and yet the water appears to retain a potency derived from that drug anyway, and many other mind-boggling ideas. But St. Georgi's thoughts on the strangeness of water in 1957 are so extraordinary that I must quote a bit of what he says. Quote, "When considering water structures, we enter a fantastic and fascinating world. Bridgman, in his studies on high pressure, could distinguish between half a score of different ices. But we need not go to ice to find structures in water. J.D. Bernal and R.H. Fowler showed water to have a quartz-like crystalline structure, which is different from that of common ice. The situation becomes more complex still if we consider water structures built around solid surfaces. The tendency of building structure-ordered layers around surfaces running deep into the fluid phase seems to be a general tendency of liquids. The surface zones of liquids are tens and hundreds of molecules deep, rather than monomolecular as commonly assumed. Water around ice behaves not as water, but as liquid ice. These layers of ice were found to be several microns deep. The building of lattices means long-range order, in which the single molecules collaborate collectively. No attempts have yet been made to apply our knowledge of water structures to living systems. Living matter seems to be a system of water and organic matter, which forms one inseparable unit, a system as the cogwheels do in a watch. Water is not only the mother, it is also the matrix of life on Earth, and biology may have been unsuccessful in understanding the most basic functions because it focused its attention only on the particulate matter, separating it from its two matrices, water and the electromagnetic field. Unquote. What is most interesting of all in this, for our purposes, is that St. Georgie grasped the importance of structure-ordered layers around surfaces within a watery mass. In other words, the concept of a mass of water containing protected or walled cells within itself, which themselves are made entirely of water. These boundary layers within water are analogous to the boundary layers known as sheaths found within plasmas. All plasmoids are enclosed by sheaths. That is how they maintain their identities. St. Georgie had a deep intuition of the extraordinarily complex, dynamic structures that inform naturally occurring materials, including ice, water, and plasma, but of which science had been ignorant before his discoveries. We have been building complex plasma entities, having countless plasmoid regions within them, all protected within their sheaths. Researchers such as Kapitsa, Bostic, and Svitovich have shown that some of the plasmoids contain hot plasmas, some cold plasmas, some dusty plasmas, some non-dusty voids, some containing specific impurities that hinder or accentuate the flows of charged particles, precisely in the manner of electronic semiconductors and transistors, by the process known as doping. Furthermore, there is the mysterious phenomenon called tunneling, to be explained in a moment, that takes place between them, and there are also superconducting and superfluid portions and sections, that water and plasma, which St. Georgie showed to be present throughout human bodies, spontaneously generate structures, adds a whole new dimension to the argument. In order to understand the implications of St. Georgie's work in more depth, and to see how it works in practice, we will look again at superconductivity and Josephson junctions, before delving back into the weird and shadowy world of Freeman Cope. Superconductivity and Josephson junctions in the lab, outer space, and human beings. It often happens in the history of science that a new scientific theory will give rise to new inventions. This is quite natural, but sometimes it happens the other way around. The invention by Brian Josephson of Josephson junctions as a device to control and regulate electric currents in complex machines helped drive the development of machine intelligence and eventually quantum computers. This in turn gave rise to theories that there might be things in nature that have similar functions. We have already touched on the idea that there might be features in complex dusty plasmas in space which have similar capabilities to computers, and that these may help the evolution of intelligence in space. Now we are going to look at features that resemble Josephson junctions in plasma in human bodies. We will do this before we actually explain Josephson junctions. The story starts in 1911 with the observation of superconductivity in a lab by the Dutch scientist Heike Kamerlingh Onnes. When electricity flows along a wire, it is called electrical conduction. When it flows through something without any resistance at all, an amazing phenomenon that scientists could barely believe when it was first discovered, it is called superconductivity. Superconductivity is entirely counterintuitive. Everything that has traditionally been known about electricity is that it encounters resistance as it flows along. And as everyone who has ever had anything to do with electronics knows, and every electrician who wires your house, the units of resistance are known as ohms. That's spelled O-H-M-S, named after the German scientist Georg Ohm, who died in 1854. At first, superconductivity was thought to take place only at extremely low temperatures near absolute zero, temperatures so low that in everyday life we never encounter them, because they have to be artificially created by scientists and technicians. But then, as time went on, it was discovered that superconductivity could take place at higher and higher temperatures. And it was discovered that current could flow in this manner through increasing numbers of materials, many of them artificial. As Freeman Cope put it, quote, "Superconduction is the passage of electron current without generation of heat, and hence with zero electrical resistance." Such behavior has been observed only in inorganic materials and only at temperatures below approximately 20 degrees K, that's on the Kelvin scale, and it's equal to minus 253.15 degrees Celsius. Although theory predicts that superconduction might occur in organic materials at room temperature. When current is flowing by superconductivity, it encounters no resistance at all. It can go on forever. It is, in fact, an electric version of a perpetual motion machine. If flowing in a coil, under suitable circumstances, the current goes round and round by itself, with no power source, and it can in principle do this for eternity. It needs no recharging. It flows like an endless river. In fact, machines creating superconductivity have been made, which, all other things being equal, will continue to flow beyond the end of the universe, if the universe should actually end, that is, which in my opinion it will not. The next great breakthrough for our purposes came in 1962, when Cambridge physicist Brian Josephson predicted with mathematical precision how a supercurrent would leap over a thin insulating barrier connecting two superconductors by means of the quantum phenomenon called quantum tunneling. This precision is key. Josephson realized that by modulating the insulating barrier between the two superconductors, the flow of current could be modified. If electricity flows too strongly and too well, it is too powerful for electronic devices and can overwhelm them. And if it cannot flow at all through an insulator, it is obviously of no use whatever. Because of what became known as Josephson junctions, it became possible to use superconducting electricity that was not too strong, but of semi-strength only. And by varying the semiconductor materials, by adding small amounts of this or that substance, what is called doping, the strength of the electric flow could be varied and fine-tuned. These junctions are what make our most advanced modern computers possible. And without semiconductors, the ordinary ones, which had been known for a long time before this, and that regulate normal electrical flow very precisely, there would be none of our contemporary electronic devices. There would be no portable computers, no cell phones, no tablets, and hence no internet, and so on. Josephson was awarded the Nobel Prize for Physics in 1973 for his discoveries. Here's another one of the Nobel laureates whom I have met and talked with about their work. He is a very shy and modest fellow, whose success in science came to him so young that he was rather intimidated by it all, and for a long time seemed to dread all the attention he received. One day I must transcribe the tapes I made of our conversation. Josephson junctions are also fundamental to the development of a quantum computer. Indeed, some scientists go so far as to speak of a Josephson quantum computer. Josephson junctions can now be made at the nanoscale, with a thickness of only 1/10 of a nanometer. They are able to act as computer switches, so sensitive that they control currents one electron at a time, letting an electron through when desired and blocking an electron when necessary. This level of control has already been perfected, and when quantum computers finally come on stream, it will probably be because of the pioneering work and insight of Brian Josephson. For radiation detection purposes, vast arrays of tens of thousands of tiny Josephson junctions, working in sync, are capable of obtaining results unobtainable by any other known means. In a dusty complex plasma that has developed emergent properties of self-organization, where superfluidity is made possible by countless layers of sheaths, cells, and crystals, we can expect superconduction and Josephson junctions to form the basis of the energy flows within the plasmas. A dusty complex plasma, such as a Kordalevsky cloud, would thus be expected to have more than a trillion, trillion, trillion Josephson junctions within it. Or just keep adding the zeros, as they would, in effect, become incalculable in number. Intelligent calculations by such conscious plasmas would be so rapid and so massive that a Kordalevsky cloud would easily have the capacity to monitor every living creature on Earth in real time and model future events for all of them. Such a cloud could thus foresee with a high degree of probability what would happen in almost any Earth situation and have models of every conceivable variable's effect on events. From the point of view of the limited human brain, a Kordalevsky cloud therefore has the capacity of what to us would be indistinguishable from omniscience. If this complexity is possible in plasmas in space, what about in the human body? We know from St. George's work that the human body contains organic semiconductors. For the achievement of the Josephson effect within our bodies, these can suffice for the necessary barriers to create the jump. The impetus for the jump can come from something called the proximity effect. When two superconducting currents are near enough to each other, they can influence each other because of their proximity, and this can result in a Josephson effect if there is an organic semiconductor available. To understand the implications of St. George's discovery in more depth, we need to dive back into the weird world of Freeman Cope. I originally discovered his publications in the mid-1970s, and as at that time I was constantly in Oxford doing research, though not living or based in Oxford, I would drive down to Oxford from the cottage where I was living, in our little Morris 1000, which had an engine like that of a lawnmower, cold wind whistling in through the soft roof, and a heater so feeble that to avoid freezing in the winter, one had to wear a heavy overcoat covering one's legs. The irony is that I was studying organic superconductivity, which generates no heat because it encounters no resistance, so it would have been of no use when driving. The journal I had discovered was Physiological Chemistry and Physics, published by the Pacific Publishing Company in Portland, Oregon, which is where they were at that time. They are now in Melville, New York. This exciting journal was packed full of astonishing articles, and they were causing me to look at the physical body in an entirely new light. As I looked into this more deeply, I discovered that William A. Little of Stanford University seems to have been the first person to start this chain of reasoning going. As early as the summer of 1964, he had published a paper in the prestigious Physical Review entitled Possibility of Synthesizing an Organic Superconductor. That's 1964. He concluded that superconductivity should occur even at temperatures well above room temperature using certain organic polymers, which are substances made up of large molecules with repeating subunits, which could have considerable biological significance. After surveying numerous technical issues, he said, quote, "This forces upon us the remarkable conclusion that superconductivity could and should occur in structures such as this, even at room temperature." These findings tied in with work Cope had been doing since 1963, and he cites in footnotes relevant publications of 1963, 1964, 1970, and 1971, when he published his first major paper making claims of superconductivity in the body, in the 1971 article I cited a moment ago. In this paper, Cope refers to electron tunneling, which is the essence of Josephson junctions. Cope says in his paper, quote, "We may predict special characteristics that superconductive biological systems should have, for which pertinent experimental data already exist. First, cells which perform single electron superconductive tunneling might also perform two-electron, that is, Josephson, superconductive tunneling, relating to nerve processes. The apparent association of superconduction with growth is indicated by the evidence of this paper." Unquote. The importance of the distinction between single and two-electron tunneling is that the latter are of a higher order when it comes to controlling the flow of currents, and they come into play when Josephson junctions are used to control superconducting currents. A Josephson junction, to put it simply, can act as a switch. The following year, in the same journal, two Hungarian scientists published a paper commenting on Cope's ideas and concluded, quote, "The electron tunneling between the mentioned regions of DNA might be responsible for the experimental facts described by Cope, if we accept his hypothesis about superconductive tunneling in biological systems." Unquote. In the spring of 1973, Cope published another paper in the same journal carrying his ideas further. In this paper, Cope said, quote, "Various species of organisms can detect weak magnetic fields of 0.1 to 5 Gauss. Gauss units, by the way, are a measurement of the field strength. Indirect evidence suggests that electron tunneling may occur across junctions between superconductive microregions in living systems. Man-made superconductive Josephson junctions have been fabricated with magnetic sensitivity as high as 10 to 11 Gauss. It is suggested that superconductive Josephson junctions in living systems may provide a physical mechanism with more than enough sensitivity to explain the observed responses of organisms to weak magnetic fields." Unquote. Considering what was said about Cope in Chapter 13, it is interesting to note that at the end of this paper, Cope states that his work was, quote, "supported in part by the Office of Naval Research Contract NR-105-717, unquote. Cope had obviously persuaded his military security agency's bosses that what he was doing deserved funding. A month later, the same journal received a paper from J.P. Martin, that's M-A-R-T-O-N, extending Cope's ideas to considerations of cancer, and this appeared in the next issue of the journal. Entitled Conjectures on Superconductivity and Cancer, the paper by Martin said, quote, on the assumption that biological cell membranes possess superconductive properties, and that dead and cancerous cells do not, the mechanism of control for embryonic, normal, and cancerous tissue growth may be explained. Unquote. The next spring, in the same journal, Solomon Goldfein, one of the brightest scientists working for the U.S. Army's Engineer Research and Development Labs in Fort Beaver, Virginia, Beaver spelt Belvoir, contributed to the discussion. Perhaps the Army did not wish to be left behind by the Navy. Goldfein's paper was entitled Some Evidence for High-Temperature Superconduction in Cholates, that's C-H-O-L-A-T-E-S, nothing to do with chocolate, and started his paper by saying, quote, when William A. Little examined Fritz Wolfgang London's idea, which was of 1937, that superconductivity might occur in organic macromolecules, he concluded that it was not only possible, but might even occur at room temperature, unquote. By summer, once again in the same journal, Cope published yet another paper in which he said, quote, superconduction is the passage of electron current without generation of heat and hence with zero electrical resistance, accompanied by particular kinds of interactions with magnetic fields. Until recently, such behavior had been observed only in certain metals, and only at temperatures below approximately 20 degrees Kelvin. Theorists have long predicted, however, that superconduction might occur in organic solids, which theoretically might superconduct even at room temperature and above. Unquote. Cope was also reporting evidence that some functions of nerves are controlled by superconduction, and he proposed that biological sensitivity to weak magnetic fields is comprehensible only in terms of a biological superconductive Josephson junction. Once again, Cope acknowledges the Office of Naval Research and Contract Number 105-717. Also, in early 1974, Professor Antoni K. Antonovich of Poland published an article entitled Possible Superconductivity at Room Temperature in Nature. This attracted wider attention and was reported in the New Scientist magazine on the 28th of February, 1974, page 525, beside a report on work by Freeman Cope. Antonovich was reported as using a sandwich of amorphous, which is to say non-crystalline, carbon between aluminium films to engineer Josephson junctions. And he, like Cope, discovered that the tunneling involved was modulated by a magnetic field. Cope next delivered a paper to a conference in 1978, the abstract only of which was published in the volume of conference proceedings by the U.S. Department of Energy. He discussed how superconductive Josephson junctions make it possible for organisms to detect not only weak magnetic fields, but also microwaves, and he referred approvingly to the work of Antonovich. Cope's full paper appears never to have been released for publication. At this point, Cope's involvement in this subject appears to have ended, and in this same year he switched his work to the dipole clouds that have already been discussed. No one else has ever done a survey of these publications, and I thought it necessary to put it all on record, as it was an important episode in the history of science. Since this flurry of exciting papers appeared, this subject has mysteriously gone quiet in America. That is often a sign that the security agencies are working on it, or if not working on it, then actively suppressing it for some paranoid reason of their own. After all, how dangerous can it be for the public to know about superconductivity taking place within the human body? But several decades of silence is extremely annoying, especially in light of the crucial importance of this almost forgotten subject. What does all of this mean for our discussion in this book? It is fundamental. We are looking at the dynamics of currents of electricity and proticity within our bodies, an interface between the plasma inside us and our physical bodies, and also, as Cope's work suggests, between our plasma selves and universal electromagnetic fields and perhaps microwaves. In other words, Cope discovered a plasma-based mechanism by which our physical bodies are affected by fields. As we will see later, quantum biologists have shown that some birds navigate their migrations by means of interaction with the Earth's electromagnetic fields, which have now been shown to cause chemical changes in their brains. Could this interface, identified by Cope, also work in much more subtle and complex ways in the human brain and account for important features of our own consciousness and behavior? This subject needs to be investigated continuously and relentlessly. Either it has been done in secret, in which case the facts need to be made public, or it has not been done, which would be a major dereliction. In 1989, an unexpected contribution to this subject appeared from Europe. A group of five authors, prominent in biophoton research, and we'll be discussing biophotons later, published a paper supportive of the idea of superconductivity in organisms. They were Emilio Del Giudice, Silvia Doglia, Marziale Milani, Cyril W. Smith, and Giuseppe Vitiello. I have had very friendly and productive relations with Smith and Vitiello for some time by email, but I missed the brilliant Emilio Del Giudice, who was no longer alive by the time I established contact. Their joint paper especially dealt with Josephson junctions in living systems. The five authors were preoccupied by what it means for long-range order to occur by correlated behavior of the elementary components of an organism. The five authors say, quote, "A living system can be considered as a set of many microscopic components whose interplay occurs through a network of mutually coupled and sequentially ordered chemical reactions. The macroscopic, which means large scale, ordering could be considered as emerging from the collective behavior of the elementary components." One of the authors, Cyril Smith, and his co-workers have, over many years, found evidence that Josephson-like phenomena are occurring in living systems. The first piece of evidence came in 1975. There is a small superconductive region with dimensions which are very small. A dispersion of such regions could give rise to an alternating current Josephson effect. A pair of nearby cells acts as a Josephson junction, which gives rise to an intercellular coherence, unquote. In other words, ordered complexity is created in organisms by means of the actions of adjoining cells influencing each other across Josephson junctions. It was impossible for Freeman Cope to enter this discussion because he had already been dead for 7 years. However, a year later in 1990, William A. Little jumped back into the fray. 26 years after his seminal paper of 1964, considered earlier. As an organizer, he took part in an international conference on organic superconductors, which took place from the 20th to the 24th of May, 1990, at South Lake Tahoe, California. This conference was funded by the deceased Freeman Cope's old employers, the Office of Naval Research, under contract N00014-90-J-1384, along with the U.S. Department of Energy. Bill Little, describing himself as principal investigator, wrote the necessary classified final report for the Navy and submitted it on November the 30th. This report has now been declassified. It contains a photo of all the participants and a chart identifying them all by numbers. The papers are not included, but abstracts of them are. Little states that the proceedings will be published by Plenum Press, and then he says, quote, "It would be appropriate to mention two items which were brought up by the participants and which might be of interest to funding agencies. The first was a perceived need to develop a better understanding of the process of electrocrystallization. The second was the remark by Professor James P. Coleman, that's C-O-L-L-M-A-N, that the field of organic conductors, organic magnets, and organic superconductors appears to many to have the potential of contributing an enormous amount to the development of new materials of commercial value in the coming years." Unquote. When the proceedings of this conference were published, containing all the papers, none of these remarks or the photo appeared. In a brief preface about the history of the subject for the preceding 25 years, Little does not mention a single one of Cope's papers, or indeed any of the other papers we have considered here, except his own of 1964. To me, this gives the appearance of a wish to conceal the earlier history of the subject, rather than to reveal and discuss it. In the large volume, Joseph's injunctions are mentioned only once, and the conference as a whole appears to have taken place in a parallel universe, where all that we have considered so far does not exist. And after this conference, the entire subject drops off a cliff, and that is the end of it, as far as the public gaze is concerned. Perhaps, quote, "the development of new materials of commercial value," unquote, and probably military value as well, was the reason for this subject going dark after 1990. In which case, I am glad to be resurrecting it, since probably no one else would ever have done so. The mechanics of superconduction within physical bodies will certainly also be found in a similar form in plasma bodies in space. There can be no doubt that superconducting regions and Joseph's injunction switches operate within plasma entities and must occur in their hundreds of millions or billions, or probably trillions, within the Kordolevsky clouds. They will be fundamental to any computing powers of the Kordolevsky clouds, and there must be hundreds of thousands of them within each one of us in both our bodies, the physical ones and the plasma ones. In addition to this, superconductivity is, as we saw in Chapter 8, bound to occur within the Birkeland currents that stream through the whole of the universe. There is no reason why such superconductivity within those galactic and intergalactic filament streams cannot travel at speeds known as relativistic, meaning near to the speed of light. As we have also seen, we know the streams of electrons within the Birkeland currents move forward in a double spiraling fashion in counter-rotating layers. Similar filaments, operating in the same or similar fashion, must exist within the Kordolevsky clouds, and at a micro level within ourselves. These are areas of research that need urgently to be pursued, as we need to know so much more. I shall add just one clue as to why this subject may have been suppressed. Everything that I have described so far could be exploited in the creation of robots that combine inorganic with organic components. There are people who write about transhumanism, which deals with this subject. The work of Cope and the others, in fact, has direct relevance to efforts to build robotic super soldiers who can enter a battlefield and kill. Kill. Isn't that wonderful?